Skeptia Radio from London, a bilingual radio to listen and think.
Okay, dear friends, ladies and gentlemen, just a quick note to welcome you all on behalf of Instituto Cervantes London. There is no doubt that Latin American novel ranks as the biggest achievement for Spanish language in the 20th century. Widely read all over the world, García Márquez, Borges, or Miguel Ángel Asturias are household names. And their genre, magical realism, is well known and appreciated by contemporary readers. Not everything in Latin American fiction, however, is magical realism, as shown by Colombian writer Andrés Caicedo, whom we're honoring and remembering today. Called even the first enemy of Macondo, Caicedo is not afraid of delving into subjects such as youth, street life, and social conflict. He has thus become something of a cult author in his own country, Colombia, and of course outside of it. And this is a status that his early death by suicide, when he was not yet in his 30s, has done nothing to avoid. It is a pity that, given Caicedo's belief in the idea of leaving behind a beautiful corpse, we were deprived of the brilliant works he would undoubtedly have written. Yet what we have, especially the party without end of Que Viva la Música, or in English, Live Forever, is pure gold. That's why we decided to focus on Caicedo for this new installment of our Latin American series, Authors in Search of a Reader, a joint project with Zetier Radio, El Ojo de la Cultura Hispanoamericana, and critics and writers Enrique Zátara and Juan Toledo, whom I'd like to thank for being with us today. As it is customary in this series, we are privileged to have with us two experts in Caicedo's work, namely linguist Gustavo García and translator Frank Wynn. Muchas gracias to both of you for coming this evening. I leave the floor to them now, and I wish you all a very inspiring evening, not without reminding you that there is a salsa club here in Embankment in case you are seduced by Caicedo's rhythm. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Ignacio for those kind words, and thank you very much for coming tonight. Well, this series, as Ignacio mentioned, is about books who have been translated into English, which are not still well-known by English readers. So one of them is Que Viva la Música by Andrés Caicedo, and I'm very, very happy to have the two people that I have with me tonight, Frank Wynn, who is responsible for bringing this book into English, and Gustavo, who is almost falling over of the platform before to get injured, you know. Yes, there's no insurance of the Cervantes. We're talking about this book, which is about Cali culture. This is a very peculiar book and remains so in Latin American literature, and remains so in two aspects. The first one, it is one of the very few novels in Latin American literature that deals with popular culture and salsa in particular. There are not many books in Latin America. We got big scheme novels like 100 Years of Solitude, like Terra Nostra by Carlos Fuentes, like Conversaciones en la Catedral by Vargas Llosa. We don't have books that deals with the real life of real people in Latin America. This is one of the novels. Also, the very peculiar thing about this novel is that it still reads well, and it's full of humor, dark humor. Probably many of you, I don't expect many of you, have read the book, because the book is not very well known outside of Colombia. And I'm very pleased to have Frank and Gustavo with me. And I'm going to start with Frank. First time you read Que Viva la Música, Now Live Forever, when did it happen? And did you read it? And then it came to you exactly saying that at the same time that I need to translate this book as a translator.
The two things didn't come together at the same time, because I started my translation career translating from French. And in 2002, I translated a novel by Michel Houellebecq, which won a prize, and I thought, okay, well, fine, I'll just give up the day job and I'll do this for a living and everything will be fine. It was another 7 years before I could actually make a living out of translating. And so for most of that time, I realized I could not afford to live in London. Actually, I couldn't really afford to live in Europe. And so I lived for most of it in originally Central America, in Costa Rica, and then subsequently in Argentina. I went there. I never studied Spanish in any form at any time. I went there with the lyrics to La Bamba and nothing else. And I have yet to find anyone to whom, yo no soy marinero, soy capitán, has ever proved to be a useful opening piece of conversation. But, as I had when I lived in France, I learned the language gradually and I began reading a lot in the language. And so I first came across Que Vive la Musica when I was in Argentina, because somebody said, you have to read this, you have to read this, you have to read this. And I got about 70 pages in and sort of slowly ground to a halt. Not because I wasn't excited by what was happening, but because it was a bit, it felt a bit like going mad. Or for those of you who are old enough and adventurous enough, it felt like taking a trip. Something I hadn't done for some years at that time, but I remembered it very well. So I had a lot of flashbacks when I first read it. At the time, it had never occurred to me that anyone would ever ask me to translate anything from Spanish, but somebody eventually did. They asked me to translate the 900-page novel by Almudena Grandes, El Corazón Helado. And after that, I figured I could probably do anything. It would all be fine. So when this came up again, and I still had my little battered copy, Penguin came to me and said, we have two things we want you to do. We've got, you know, all of the poetry and letters and other writings of Pablo Picasso, and we have this little novel by Andrés Caicedo. And I went, okay, fine. I said, well, the Andrés Caicedo is, you know, it's a little girl, she goes to bed and, you know, ends up in a terrible place, and, you know, I'm about 6 months, you know, we'll be fine. I said, the Picasso might take a little bit longer. The Picasso took, I don't know, 8-12 months. After 6 months of Que Vive la Musica, I went back to Adam Freudenheim, who was my editor, and said, okay, this is going to take at least 2 years, and I want more money. He said, you can have 2 years. And that was that. And in the end, it did take me a little more than 2 years to do. And I couldn't work on it full time. The problem, when you read for pleasure, when you simply pick up a book and read it, all you're interested in is moving forward and moving forward. And there are lots and lots of things you take for granted. So, for example, the names of every flower and every tree in the valley towards the end of this novel are hugely important in the book if you're a translator. If you're reading, it's just, well, look, another flower, and I don't know what it looks like, it could be anything, you know. I don't know whether it's a mushroom or a tree or a, you know, it could be anything. But that doesn't matter to you when you're reading, because as you're reading for pleasure, you just move forward with the book, and the book dictates how fast you're moving. When you're translating, you need to actually know what all of these things are. And the great problem, which I discovered on page 1, line 3, is that Que Vive la Musica is written not only in Colombian slang, but Caleña slang and Caleña slang of the 1970s. And they're all dead now. Or their drugs have done terrible things to their brains. So these things are not, let me tell you, in the Royal Academy Dictionary of Spanish. They're just not. I've looked, and they're not there. And then there are all the secondary problems, which is that when I first read it, I didn't notice that half of the second part of the novel is made up of lyrics and titles of salsa songs. How would I know? But once I began to find that there were definitely things that were definitely salsa songs, I then suddenly had to Google almost every phrase that seemed in case it was a salsa song. And almost always it was. That's the short answer.
Indeed. And talking about salsa, Gustavo, you are a truly Anglo-Colombian in the sense that you have both cultures within you. Much more than I have, or many people I know, and also Cali in particular. Now, you read the book here in England for the first time. When you read it, and knowing Cali, because you know Cali, what was your experience as a reader, knowing Cali, or the Cali that you know from here, from London, and being a regular visitor?
Hello, everybody. My experience of reading the book, I suppose, because I grew up in London and visiting Cali very regularly, almost on a yearly basis throughout my early childhood and through to my adult life as well. I mean, I was born in the 70s, but right at the very end of the 70s. So I was born after the novel was written and published. But I grew up knowing Cali during the 1980s quite well. And then in the 90s as well, which I remember a bit better. But the Cali that I know is not the Cali that's represented in the book. For example, in La Mona, the main character in the novel, she's from the north of Cali, and she, I get the sense that she's a bit more maybe middle class, and she has a view of the south of Cali as being a bit more urban and working class and tough and gritty, and that's where the salsa is taking a stronghold. Now, when I was younger, I remember being in the south of Cali in a place called Ciudad Jardín, which is full of traquetos, you know, and drug traffickers and very wealthy people as well. And that's in the south of Cali. And now, and I was there last year, I was in a place called Barrio Pance, because Cali has grown. That's another thing. And now the south of Cali, there are parts in the south of Cali which are incredibly wealthy. And so it's very far removed from the Cali from, which is my father's generation, my parents' generation. So I felt like I had a window into my parents' young life, that kind of window into a secret life, which they would never have shared with me, because it's to do with things that you don't share with your children. So it was a really, really interesting, and I felt very connected to my, something that I've always felt a spiritual connection to, but have always been, because of the nature of my generation, I've always felt a little bit slightly removed from. And so that novel spoke to me very, very clearly about, I suppose, where I came from originally.
Thank you. Frank, let's move into the translation itself. Two questions. The first question is that the title is Que Viva la Música, and it's very central to the novel, the word música. And the title in English is Live Forever. So that's the first question. Why? The second question is a more ambiguous one, so to speak, and is that it's so colloquial. There's so much colloquialism from Cali and Colombianisms there. And it's about the balance that you, as a translator, that you do. We were talking with Gustavo about this before coming here, about being legible to English readers or being truthful to the Spanish version of the book. And how do you manage both?
Well, the title is not my fault. I mean, I chose the eventual title that it has, I did choose. Penguin, as a publisher, have routinely published novels that have titles that are not in English. So Alain Fournier's Le Grand Moulin or Belle du Seigneur, and I had proposed that we call it Que Vive la Musica. It's really, really not that difficult to understand, even for a really stupid English person. It's pretty obvious. I said, if you really, really want, you can take out the leading exclamation mark and the que, and you can just say Vive la Musica, and I'll still be happy. I said, on the other hand, I refuse it. And originally, that was what it was called. That's what my contract says. That's where we were until we almost came to proof. And that was round about the time of the Penguin Random House merger. And it was decided across the board that no title published by Penguin could have a foreign title or a foreign word in it. They had to have an English title. And I flatly refused to call it Let the Music Live, which sounds like a bad 70s disco song, or Long Live the Music, which sounds like a worse 70s disco song. And so I picked on Live Forever. It comes very, very late in the novel. It is, in fact, one of the plants that's named at the end, and one to which she likens herself, which it so happens is called Siempre Viva in Spanish, and is called Live, as a plant, is called Live Forever as a single word in English. So because that is partly what she aspires to, and because it's certainly taken as a single word, is that much more interesting. On the other hand, I have had lots of people come up to me and say, I don't understand what Oasis have got to do with this. Those are people I usually hit, though, so that's fine. In terms of slang, negotiating slang is the most... Negotiating slang and dialect are the most difficult things that any translator does at all, ever. And one of the things that I discovered when translating Spanish was that I had to translate Spanishes. And I was furious, having translated, you know, a Peruvian novel by Alonso Cueto, to move on to a Colombian novel and discover that actually everything, register, slang, the whole thing, you've got a fucking border, for God's sake, you know. You could at least be mutually intelligible. But then I thought, but Scotland, England, you know. The most important thing, I believe, and it's a very personal belief, is that you don't want to end up translating slang in particular in such a way that it begins to sound as though the novel is not set in Colombia, in Argentina, in Paris, in Lyon, in wherever, but is, you know, I translated a novel which is set in Barrio 21 outside of Buenos Aires, which is a shantytown, and which, as I explained to the editor at the time, if I had simply translated the slang straightforwardly, it would sound as though it were set in Brixton or in Baltimore. And that would actually completely distort what life there is like. So, and with this, okay, so this is not only slang, but it is 70s slang. American 70s slang is either, you know, very West Coast, you know, sub-Beach Boys. I was not going to refer to women as chicks here. I mean, apart from anything else, the feel of it is completely wrong. But also 70s American slang is mostly hippie slang until it becomes disco slang, and disco slang's too late for this. English slang is generally, except when it comes to insulting people, much less flavorful. So actually, I had to try and carve out something that was somewhere between the two, that used bits and pieces of slang that weren't either too American or too English, and then include bits and pieces and certainly words like pelada and so forth, where actually it was easier to contextually explain, it was easier to use the word and make sure that the reader understood it than it was to translate it. And it reminds the reader where they are. And it's quite crucial to reminding the reader where they are. I mean, there are other words that I have to keep because salsa is not only, I mean, particularly salsa of the 1970s is not entirely written in Spanish. It's written in Yoruba and in gibberish and in things that Richie Ray and Bobby Cruz thought up when they were taking drugs and before they found God.
They did.
They really did. They tour now. They have a sort of Jesus tour these days, which they go around and try and help people. I don't want to be saved. So a lot of that, a lot of what you try to preserve in a sense of place needs to be, you know, it's in the same way. I've just translated a book that's largely set on a farm in rural France and takes place between about 1914 and about 1980. People with rural French accents cannot talk as though they are members of the Archers or come from a West Coast farm. Or, on the other hand, I need to find a register that clearly makes it clear that they are not terribly educated, that they are rural people, that they are familiar with animals, and so you take bits from a variety of things rather than wholesale. I mean, that wasn't always the case. I mean, there was a time, particularly in translations into English, where we just domesticated everything. Yeah. I mean, the first translation of Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth, which is written in France but takes place in Hamburg and then in Iceland, in its first English translation is set in Aberdeen. And the names of all the characters are different. Yeah. And there's an additional chapter because it was felt that there wasn't much of a moral element in there. So the translator added another chapter.
The role of the translator. I remember also about Borges, for example, translating Edgar Allan Poe and taking big chunks of Edgar Allan Poe because they thought it was boring. What's the point about translating that? So you have a different version. But I hope that you realize that this is the first time that some Anglo-Saxon swear word has been said here in public at the Cervantes Institute.
I was very careful not to use a swear word that you would understand.
Okay, good. But before we go into the context of the novel, Gustavo, I want to talk about salsa and the importance of salsa in the novel, because it's crucial to the novel. And salsa as a counterculture in Colombia. But fundamentally, Cali as the center of salsa in Colombia. Why Cali? Why no Barranquilla? Why Colombia? Why no Venezuela? Why no other countries in the mainland Latin America?
That's interesting you say counterculture, because I'll go back to what I said earlier about being of my generation, because my earliest memories of Colombia and of Cali, salsa was not counterculture, it was the culture. Yeah. And in Cali during the 80s and 90s, salsa was everywhere. That you'd get onto a bus and there would be salsa, and in a taxi you'd hear salsa, and at
omnipresent
at the nightclubs, in the bars, even at the corner shop where you could go and buy a beer and sit on some crates of beer and have your beer, and there's salsa in the background. and salsa is everywhere. And as a bicultural person, one of my earliest memories was of the. I'm going slightly off topic here. Sorry. I'm a football fan. I remember watching the football matches. I remember when Colombia beat Argentina famously 5-0 in the World Cup qualifiers for 1994. I remember every time a goal was scored by the Colombia national team, there was tropical dancing, danceable music, and the narrator of the commentator, when they sing the goal, there's that a kind of sense that it certainly is not counterculture.
Yeah.
The kind of, for want of a better word, the tropical music permeates all spheres of Colombian society in my Colombia that I knew. I think historically, when salsa first arrived in Colombia, I think the historical reasons for that probably are more to do with the fact that during the 1940s, Colombia underwent a period of civil strife, and Cali was one of the economic centers. And so two things happened. I think the Afro-Colombian communities from the Pacific coast migrated in towards Cali. And at the same time, the presidential nominee who was likely to win, Jorge Eliezer Gaitán, was murdered. And so that provoked a period known as El Bogotazo and then La Violencia. And as a result of that, I think lots of rural people also migrated towards the cities, and the internally displaced people arrived in Cali. And so I think the population grew from something like 100,000 to almost 700,000 people. And it was
20 years.
In a very short period of time. And it was primarily rural people who were internally displaced, as well as Afro-Colombians from the Pacific coast. So I think, I can only imagine that during that time, the Cali that emerged was a very, very different Cali from the one that there was 20 years prior to that. And with a huge variety of different cultural experiences. I imagine, because I wasn't there in the 1940s, I imagine that it was not a homogenous society, but quite a diverse one. And it certainly didn't have its own autochthonous musical tradition. And at the same time, I think the invention of the digital, the analog radio, which arrived in Colombia during the 1930s, would have brought with it music from Cuba, and therefore the guaracha, the rumba, the cha-cha-cha, the sounds, charanga, all of these musical rhythms from Cuba would have reached all of the Americas. And that would have coincided with a nascent population in Cali, which, as I mentioned, did not have its own autochthonous music because it was almost a brand new society. So I think that kind of lent itself to this new society. And I think the other thing is the fact that given that Cali is quite a black society, and I wonder whether also the lyrical contents of salsa, they mention things which I think speak to the kind of post-colonial experience to do with slavery. I think the fact that there are lots of lyrics in Yoruba, which came from West Africa and Nigeria, and the fact that there are references to Santeria, references to El Trapiche, La Molienda, the sugarcane industry. These lyrics came from Cuba, where all of these things were the case, but they were also the case in Cali. Because in Cali, if you arrive in the airport, and the airport's not actually in Cali, it's near to Palmira, which is the neighboring city, town, city, I'm not sure, city.
The biggest barrio.
The biggest barrio in Cali, yeah, is Palmira. And on your way to Cali, you pass acres and acres of monocultivo of sugarcane. I can only imagine that people listening to these lyrics from Cuba in the 1940s, where they're being exposed to lyrics to do with their ancestors, their ancestry, which is a story of slavery, of forced labor. And the caleños would have been hearing songs where the geography, it speaks to them. They understand the geography. They understand because it's the same. They understand the cultural traditions of the songs that are being played. So I think perhaps that coupled with the fact that it was a brand new population sprawling because of the internal displacement of peoples and migration from the Pacific coast, which is an Afro-Colombian place, I think all of that kind of created a perfect storm for salsa to take hold. Yeah, I think that's probably part of the reason.
It's very interesting, the whole thing about why salsa took root in Cali. We are going to do something we haven't done in this presentation. We are going to play some music, and I'm going to ask Frank a question, and then I'm going to ask Fermin to play the first song for about 1.5 minutes, which is a song called Que Viva la Música. Probably, I believe, Andres took the title of his novel from that song, from Rey Barreto. Is Que Viva la Música?
Yeah, Rey Barreto.
Rey Barreto.
Richie Ray.
Richie Ray, Bobby Cruz, but Rey Barreto was the original one. But then, and then I will ask Gustavo to read the first part of the novel. But before that, I'm going to ask Frank a question, and we go into the content of the novel. For me as a reader, the content is very subversive on many levels. It's subversive of the level about culture. He mentions the word culture several times here in the book.
And ambiguous. It's almost a dirty word.
Yes, it's almost a dirty word indeed in this, and he has to be subverted. So he's subverted on many accounts. He's subverted about the narrator being a woman. Mm-hmm. He's a man, but the heroine of the novel is a woman. Secondly, it's about salsa as a counterculture. Gustavo was saying that when he knew Cali was part of the culture, but it started as a counterculture, particularly in the early 70s. The only people who listened to salsa were people from the poor neighborhoods, Juanchito and the south of Cali, etc. But also about the language itself. There's a lot of things about drugs. For example, the first time he introduced the narrator to drugs, Ricardo El Miserable, who is probably Andrés Caicedo himself, he uses Los de Abajo, a novel about the struggle of poor people in Mexico to chop the cocaine lines. So it's all these elements about subversion, about culture, particularly a very conservative culture like Colombian culture.
Well, Andrés himself was a nice middle-class boy from a very nice middle-class family. And he didn't really like being nice middle-class or... So, I mean, culture in here, I mean, this is a war of culture, and Andrés was very torn. He was very interested in English language and American culture. He had run a cine club in Cali for years. He wrote more than 1,000 reviews of films, which are published in 3 vast novels and vast collections these days. He was reading Lovecraft and Edgar Allan Poe in English when he was a teenager. He was obsessed with the films of Hitchcock, but also with French films and so forth. There was this aspirational thing that culture was possibly English language and certainly European. And in part, salsa was for poor people because it was all they could aspire to. Now, I have no sense, not even talking to Rosario or to Sandro Romero or to Luis Ospina, who were friends of his at the time, that he ever disliked or despised it, but nonetheless, it was sort of glossed over as being less important because it's ours, and it's and also because it is not a, salsa is not a an intellectual pursuit. It is very physical and very corporeal and very hedonistic. So, in some sense, while he is Ricardito el Miserable, he is also Maria del Carmen. He is venturing away from his nice, safe neighborhood and, who knows, having sex and taking drugs with people, you know. And for someone who was as shy as he was and found it as difficult to relate to people as he did. But it is, I mean, when Maria del Carmen talks about culture, I mean, she both talks about the culture of, you know, here she is a nice middle-class girl reading Das Kapital because that's what you do, that's how you're going to subvert the world. And she finds a much better way of subverting the world by actually what she ends up calling the culture of my country, which of course is not the culture of her country, it's the culture of someone else's country. By then, it is very much the culture of Cali. And the culture of her country then is, it is salsa as music, but it is salsa as a form of liberation, as a form of movement. And one of the most difficult things about translating this novel is that by about a third of the way, half the way through the novel, about 10% of everything that remains is actually salsa. And it informs, so it is lyrics from salsa, it is titles of salsa songs, it is references to salsa, But these are used in dialogue. People are saying them to each other as though they were real things. And so it actually begins to shape her and to shape the novel. And this is, I mean, but this is a very bittersweet freedom because she does not end well. And as we know from the introduction, when he says, this book is no longer dedicated to Clarisolcita, since as she grew up, she became so much like my heroine, she no longer deserved it. Clarisolcita was one of a pair of twins that Andres knew when he was, from the age when he was about 17 or 18, they would have been much younger, they were 13, 14. And they worshipped him and they hung around all the time. But he was so disappointed that actually she lived this and in a way that he felt destroyed who she was.
It's quite interesting what you said about, because he writes as a narrator who is feminine, a feminine narrator, a woman, a subversion in itself, and then at the same time he introduced himself in the book. But what I'm going to ask Fermín to do is, thank you Fermín, to play a couple of minutes of the first song, which is Que Viva La Música, which I suspect, I don't know, I might be, I'm speculating here.
That's definitely where he got the
title. The song that he got the title from. And then I will ask Gustavo to read the first part of the novel. Because in the first part of the novel, Frank actually sorts out one of the problems. It's about La Mona. La Mona, for any Colombian person or anybody who knows Colombia, La Mona means a person who is blonde, a woman who is blonde, La Mona. And she's monísima. As you know, in the Spanish, you can have these superlatives, monísima, aburridísima, etc. So you will see how Frank sorts out the monísima problem at the beginning. But let's listen to Que Viva La Música by Ray Barreto for a couple of minutes. The rhythm. Many people don't know, well, people like Gustavo and Frank know, but salsa started not in Latin America, started in the United States. It's an United States movement by migrants who moved to the United States. And talking to Frank before this program, we were talking about, I was saying to Frank, do you think that the Cuban Revolution actually forced salsa to be invented in the United States by Puerto Rican migrants in New York? And probably that's the case. I don't know. Did we agree on that or not?
Up to a point. I mean, certainly, by the time you get to what is called salsa rather than the sort of earlier iterations in Cuba, I mean, Cuba had been a rich boy's playground throughout the 40s and 50s for Americans. And when, you know, after the revolution, quite a lot of them moved because the places that they played and the people who paid them and the lives that they had lived were no longer livable. So, you know, the fact that Richie Ray and Bobby Cruz spent, you know, all of their lives pretty much afterwards in New York was, I mean, it was a choice, but it was, but also it meant that salsa then developed within the Hispanic community was in New York and in other Hispanic and Latin American communities. And I mean, in part, Gustavo's entirely right. I mean, partly what anchored it in Cali, I mean, this going back as far as the 40s and 50s, was the fact that Buenaventura was an extraordinarily important port, that there was a very large black population in Cali, much larger than anywhere else, and both rhythmically and in terms of its themes, in terms of the things that it sings about, are about poverty and, I mean, not quite about slavery, but we're close to it. So it did absolutely speak to them. I mean, in Colombia, in the late 40s, there were only four radio stations. By the mid-50s, there are 10, and four of them are salsa stations. And all of them are broadcasting from Cali. And it becomes, I mean, in the same way that blues and jazz grew out of a way of stating what one's life was, this became a badge of honor for those people who were performing it. And a lot of what we consider, you know, I mean, by the time we talk about the sort of salsa of the 1970s, I mean, Salsa Dura comes out of Cali. It doesn't come out of New York and it doesn't come out of Cuba. I mean, basically, salsa was not fast enough, hard enough, or driving enough for caleños. They wanted it even faster, even harder, and even more driving. But, yeah, there is a sense in which, you know, I mean, upheaval in communities generally, and certainly the Cuban Revolution meant that the very long, deeply unequal party that existed in Cuba, where rich white people came and took advantage of the whole island, was over. And with Frank Sinatra and everyone else, many of the people who would go on to be major members, I mean, certainly for it to be recorded thereafter, that wasn't going to happen in Cuba. There wasn't the facility. There wasn't anything like it.
Infrastructure, yes. It requires a big infrastructure. It requires like big American bands with a lot of musicians, a lot of instruments. There's a lot to talk about. For example, when Frank refers about the salsa in Cali to being faster, and Gustavo reminded me how they used to play the 33 and a half at 45, basically the records. They speed up the records in order to make the salsa even faster. But we are not going to get into that conversation. I'm going to ask Gustavo to read the first part of the book, just to give you a flavor of what the book, at least in Frank's translation, is.
I'm blonde, blondissima. So blonde that guys say, "Hey, angel, you only have to flick that lustrous mane of hair over my face to free me of the shadow hounding me." It was no shadow on their faces, but death, and I was scared to lose my sheen. Anyone seeing my hair these days wouldn't really understand. You have to factor in the night as it draws in, bringing with it a strange mist. Plus, I'm talking about the old days, and, well, good times and bad habits have robbed even my locks of their lust. But there was a time they'd say, "Hey, Bella, I just gotta say, your hair's dazzling." And some creepy, prematurely bald guy, Lillian Gish, had hair like yours. And I was thinking, who's she? Some famous singer? I recently found out she was a silent movie star. All this time, there was I imagining her with strings of necklaces, blonde to her fingertips, belting it out as the crowd went wild. It's amazing the stuff you don't know. Everyone else knew all about music. Everyone except me. Because I had 1,000 things going on in my head. I was a good girl. Okay, not exactly a good girl. I was always screaming and throwing tantrums and fighting with Mama. But I read books, and I can still remember the 3 study sessions we arranged to read Das Kapital. Me, Armando, the cricket, we call him the cricket because of his baffled bug eyes that were always checking out my knees, and Antonio Manriquez. 3 mornings, those study sessions lasted, and I swear I totally got it. Every last word, the culture of my country. I don't want to start thinking about all that now. It's all very well remembering stuff, but wanting to remember such dedication and devotion is something else. What I want is to start my story from the day I first missed the study session, because that was the day I first slipped into the world of music, records, and dancing. I plan to tell my tale in detail, and I know my gentle reader won't be bored. I know I've already got you spellbound. That morning, I woke up so late that even with my eyes open, I couldn't summon any energy. But I thought, just put one foot on the cold tiles, and you'll see. You'll get there on time. I was kidding myself. The study session started at 9 a.m., and by now it was, what, noon? I set my small, pale feet on the tiles and felt a shudder run through me as I realized I could walk one tile at a time. So off I set, happily taking baby steps, with no goal beyond making it as far as the window. I drew the curtains, and the sight of my outspread arms reminded me what a determined young woman I was. One of those were incapable, as they say, of tilling the earth with their bare hands if they have a mind to. Not me. With the curtains open, I found myself staring at the Venetian blinds. Is it true that Venice brings death? I only mention it because it's something I used to hear, not anymore, in old songs. I could have pulled the cord, raised the Venetian blinds, like a sailor hoisting a sail, and let the new day stream into the room in all its glory. I didn't. I leaned closer. Only the slightest movement, but one I knew was tainted. And I slatted the new day through the blinds, and suddenly I longed for night, for the twilight, the color of the sky, the wind in my face, just the way I like it. It's the wind that gives my hair its strength, its perfume.
Well, the Rolling Stones are quite important in this novel too. There's a conversation between the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, in Caleño style. In Caleño style. Hola, hola, que hizo con la pelada, that kind of stuff. And the other thing to say, when I was living in Colombia as a child, Andrés Caicedo was a film critic. He had not written a novel. He had written a novel, El Atravesado, mm-hmm. which nobody knew. He actually committed suicide the same day when the novel was published. And we were talking to Gustavo about that. I'm talking to Rosario, his mm-hmm. sister. The novel was written in a short period of time between Los Angeles in 1973 mm-hmm. and finishing in Cali, sold in 1974. So about a year and a half. And then by December 1974, the novel was finished. Then he had 3 years to actually get the novel published. Nobody published the novel because the Colombian society was so conservative that they were scandalized by the language and the content of the book. The Ministry of Education, or the Ministry of Culture in Colombia, led by somebody called Juan Gustavo Cobo Borda, was the one who actually published the novel for the first time. The day when the novel was published, he committed suicide. And we were speculating with Gustavo before having this conversation about he actually waited for the moment to have the novel published. I don't know if you will agree with this, Frank, just to commit suicide. I'd like, you know, I've done it, that's it. It has to be said also that he had attempted suicide before.
I mean, there is a line in the novel that says to live beyond the age of 25 is madness, and he was 25 when he died. It was not the first time he'd attempted suicide. It was the third time in 6 months. And it was the day he received copies of it. He'd had a falling out with his girlfriend. I don't think it came... I think it was a terrible shock, but not a surprise to his friends and to his family that he took his life. It's unfortunate that we don't have the plays, and that we don't have the stories. I mean, this is the only novel, but actually there is quite a lot of other writing, including the reviews. And he had been a filmmaker and had adapted a lot of works, had written a lot of works for the stage, many of which are still being performed in Medellin now. So, I mean, culturally, he had already made a mark. This was a very different thing. And there is, I mean, from Angeles Empatanados to here is a smallish step. But this effectively says everything he had to say that was both positive and negative about what he felt about his life and his world. He also felt that he'd failed. I mean, the journey to Los Angeles, to the States, and to Los Angeles in particular, was intended for him to work in cinema, and especially if he could, to work with Roger Corman. He had written screenplays, which he had taken with him, and he came back feeling very defeated by the fact that he had gone and had felt that he had achieved nothing. And in the direct aftermath of his death, I mean, his family were a very good Catholic family, and the notion that their son had committed suicide, or their brother had committed suicide, was more shameful than anything else. I mean, and has meant that, for example, his older sisters, who partly control The copyright in his unpublished works refused to allow his letters and his diaries to be published.
Controversy was still going on in Colombia about.
No. I mean, the trouble is, you know, as Rosario occasionally says, until they die and I get all the rights, none of this will ever be published. She's the youngest of the sisters. But again, she was disowned. She moved to the States, you know, very early. I mean, she moved with her husband when she was 22, 23. Yeah. I mean, before
Andres went to the States.
Yeah, before Andres even died. Yeah. But she was later disowned because she's in a lesbian relationship with a woman for the last, you know, 30 years. And in Massachusetts as well. I mean, it gets worse and worse. I don't think there's any single reason. I think, like a lot of people who are frantically intelligent. And I mean, if we ignore all of the references to both rock music in here, which, I mean, this is a journey from rock music into salsa, all of the references to Lovecraft, to Edgar Allan Poe, to Hitchcock, he was a sponge. He absorbed everything around him and wrote about it and thought about it and attempted to reprocess it. Indeed. And I think that in and of itself can cause problems for people.
This bit here, in answer to the question, was he waiting for the novel to be published before committing suicide? At the end of the novel, he signs the novel the name of María del Carmen Huerta, who's the protagonist. And he puts in brackets the letters AC, which are his initials, Andrés Caicedo. So in her voice, he says, si dejas obra, muere tranquilo. If you leave a piece of work, then you die peacefully. So I think he probably was waiting the day that his novel was published in order to commit suicide.
Yes, I mean, the last piece, the discography, of course, is attributed to Rosario, to Rosario Wurlitzer, obviously being the machine, but it is to her. But it is from the manifesto at the end that he says, you know, if you leave work, then you can die in peace. But it also says, there's nothing more different or less inclined to reconciliation. Practice fear, rape, struggle, violence, perversion, and the anal route if you believe that satisfaction depends on tightness and a dominant position. If you prefer to withdraw from all sexual congress, so much the better. And in some level, he did. The manifesto at the end is very strange. I mean, he leaves Maria del Carmen's voice at that point. She no longer sounds like the character that we have followed through the entire novel. This is a single tirade that he is directing directly at the reader.
Yeah. Because death, the question is about gender, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed, obviously I reread the novel, and I realised at the end, the tirade that La Mona has at the end of the novel, I noticed that there are some gender... I don't know whether you... Between falling off the stage and switching the microphone off, I'm not doing a great job, but... I noticed that at the end of the novel, the main character refers to... It, obviously, Spanish is a language where nouns have gender. So every noun is either masculine or feminine. The English language doesn't have this. So there is a... let's see, actually. In the Spanish, is no te sientas genesita nunca. And genesita, don't feel... how did you translate that? Don't... I'll leave it to the expert. But it's the female version of the adjective.
Yeah,
But earlier, within the same tirade, she says...
He says?
Well, no, she says, because it's La Mona who's speaking. She says something about don't let...
Never grown up a respectable man.
Yeah, to a respectable man. So she's talking to the reader, and in one respect, she's talking to you, the reader, as though you are a man, and then she talks to you, the reader, as though you are a woman.
Yeah.
And this is something which I suspect you haven't translated because of...
What I've done, where I needed to, is added the word man or the word woman, because I've had to, because it's the... I mean, you cannot gender nouns in English, and at this point, if I start to try and calc a noun, nobody's going to know that an A ending or an O ending is in, shifts. So where I could, I've made it clear. But the only way to do that is to add information that isn't, that is much more subtle in the original, because as you say, the noun itself is gendered in the original, so I can shift from one to another with a single vowel, whereas in English I need to actually say that something man, that something woman, unless it happens to be a profession, in which case, you know, there might be a way of doing it. No, there is a, there's quite a, that whole piece at the end has a shift between singular and plural and male and female, and who she is addressing and whether they are one or multiple and whether they are readers or a generation ahead is very, very difficult to take in. I mean, she appears to be directly addressing the reader as something that is both male, female, singular, plural, and probably pansexual, and ideally, as he slash she says, asexual.
Do you think that's partly to do with Andrés Caicedo as a person who maybe was slightly androgynous and...
Yes.
Suspiciously, yeah. Well, yeah. Probably bisexual.
Yes, I think it has a lot to do with the fact that he was androgynous, the fact that he was certainly bisexual. I mean, there was a longish term lover that he had, but also that was something that he was very conflicted about, and his writings about it exist really only in some of the love letters that he wrote in some of his diaries. And there is, of course, quite a lot of androgyny in popular culture at the time. I mean, particularly yeah. coming out of,
Anglo-Saxon.
I mean, Mick Jagger could still pass as being androgynous back then.
David Bowie was
very much so.
Yeah.
And also the flirtation of filmmakers like Nick Rigg in performance and so forth. These were things that he was very aware of. So yes, I think that actually, you know, I mean, as I said, I think that in part, a part of him is Maria del Carmen. A part of him is also Ricardito el Miserable, who ends up, you know, in an insane asylum. Where everything is a tick box.
Yeah, it's a brilliant part, yes. But just a question to you. I mean, there's so many things that we could do with this novel. But the thing about the culture and the androgynous culture on the Anglo-Saxon world and the Colombian world, and culture being these terms with certain amount of disdain or sarcasm, so to speak, do you think that it is that contrast between the Anglo-Saxon culture that he learned from being self-educated, because he was a self-taught man, so many films and so many books and so many cultural references from the English-speaking world, comparing that with the culture of Colombia at that time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that it directly, everything that he had taken from Anglo-Saxon culture and American culture was directly, I mean, Poe is a very strange influence. I mean, the imagery within Poe is very strange, and he uses towards the end in the killing sequence in the mountains, he uses a number of direct quotes from Poe that he's translated, the glittering teeth like pearls from a necklace and so forth. But also, I mean, Poe himself is an odd character. I mean, he married his 13-year-old cousin. And then famously didn't sleep with her until she was nearly dead. She did die quite quickly. But, you know, he grew up in a very macho culture at a time that was hugely macho. So this is all, and he was, I mean, it's not just that he was androgynous, he was slightly effeminate. I mean, most people looking at, and he chose to wear his hair long, and most people looking at him almost certainly assumed that he was gay. Certainly in Cali, I mean, we're not in Cartagena here, you know, we're in, you know. And also this is part of the subversion that this is all about, is, I mean, what Maria del Carmen does is she takes, I mean, she begins by thinking that reading communism is the culture of her country. But in fact, what is the culture of her country is taking possession of herself wholly and controlling what she does. And, I mean, the one thing that she is not, although her living on the corner, the street corner she lives in at the end, may not be what her parents would have wished for her, she has entirely controlled her own destiny. She is not a victim of any of these people. Both with an E and without. But I mean, all of this is a subversion of a culture that in which I assume, he couldn't not feel uncomfortable, because it is the terrible balance of the 50s and 60s, and, you know, which are about, you know, horsemen and carrying off women and so forth. All of this is entirely at odds with what fascinates him. Yes, I've lost my train of thought, but there you go.
We're trying to wrap up because we want you to ask the panel a few questions, though, Gustavo and Frank. We're going to do things. I'm going to ask Gustavo a question. Then we're going to play Ricardo Rey, Sonido Bestial, just a couple, 1 minute, a minute and a half. I'm going to ask Gustavo to read this psychiatric questionnaire, just as a kind of silly wrap up. But one question to you, Gustavo, as a reader, and as an Anglo-Colombian, as I said. When you read the novel, you got certain premonitions about what Colombian society was going to become, particularly in terms of violence. Well, violence is there. It's interesting, you talk about El Mechudo, the people with long hair. Yeah. What happened in the first person who appears in the novel? He gets killed by Las Águilas Negras, who nowadays is a well-known paramilitar assassin group in Colombia. And the other thing is about the drug culture. Did you see the incipient growing of what became a fundamental aspect, and in fact, culture of a country like Colombia in the novel?
I suppose that there are references to drug use in the novel. It's inescapable. I don't think it's the first. There's a novel called De Sobremesa by the man who appears in a 20,000 peso bill. I can't remember his name. Asunción Silva. And in that novel, the main character, he also references drug taking, and that novel precedes this novel by a long time. However, this novel was written in the early 70s, published in the mid to late 70s, and I think it does predate slightly the whole narcocultura that everyone is familiar with nowadays. And in the book, I think it's Ricardito el Miserable, one of the characters who Andrés Caicedo we identify with. There are some references with cocaine in there. So of course there are some early allusions to drugs, but I suppose it's something that I think the whole drug label is a bit of an unfair label to attach to a novel by a Colombian writer, because the novel is very well written, and I think that is what should be highlighted rather than the drug culture, because it's far too easy to associate any cultural product from Colombia with drugs. And I think this is a novel where we could talk about music, we could talk about rock and roll, we can talk about salsa, we can talk about his style of writing, we can talk about any number of things. I think when Colombia gets mentioned, I would rather that we spoke about literature.
I mean, drugs are, yes, they're a part of the novel, but actually they're a part of the novel more in a sort of Aldous Huxley Doors of Perception way. I mean, in fact, the only truly bad drug in this is heroin, which is seen as entirely American. It's being brought back from America by Leopoldo, and it ends up with all of her first group of friends. These are people who are supposed to be heavy rockers, lying on the floor, listening to Chicago at the most minimal volume. Chicago, I mean, thankfully, most of you are too young to have ever listened to Chicago. Don't. That is sort of drugs as death. Actually, cocaine, which does feature, though not all that much, is much less so. And then we're into hallucinogens. And we're never really told what the hallucinogens are, and it doesn't really matter. This is more about, you know, an opening of perception. What it's certainly not is about, you know, narcocultura. It's not... nor is it tied to the production of it, or even to, I think, its predominance there. I mean, I think actually, in precisely the way that in the 20s and 30s in England, cocaine was seen as a problem among aristocrats and the middle classes and the educated. At the time in Colombia, cocaine or drugs more generally were more likely to be taken by hippies and people who were into some form of counterculture. I mean, I remember reading in a novel many years ago, a detective novel, where the detective says, you do realize that drugs are not simply a problem of the upper classes. Nobody these days thinks that. Everybody thinks that it's precisely the reverse. But in fact, actually, it is the middle classes who bring, you know, bring drugs.
And he finds it quite funny because in some part of the novels he said that Ricardito il Miserable, his mom brings cocaine from the United States for him, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, you know. Well, it's
indeed. A little American. But we're going to play Richie Ray, 1 minute and a half. Then we're going to finish with the psychiatric questionnaire. And then we open questions to the public just to wrap it up. Because Richie Ray is huge, and he was huge in Cali. And he's one of the salsa dura, isn't it?
Yeah.
The classical salsa. Salsa changed a lot, but this is what you used to listen in Cali at the early 1970s. Colombia has its own salsa with fruco insultersos and stuff, but this is the kind of thing that came from Puerto Rico.
So one of the greatest scenes in the book is Ricardito actually manages to go to the only Richie Ray and Bobby Cruz concert that ever happened in Cali. Unfortunately, he's slipped a couple of quaaludes before he gets there, and then a couple of Purple Hearts just as he goes in the door because he's had them down in his underpants. And there is an extraordinarily hilarious scene of him attempting to negotiate through the crowd, which is sort of going in and out of focus and crawling between their legs and so forth, until eventually he vomits onto a pot plant, and the color of his vomit is the color of the Colombian flag. But it's an amazing, and it then says Richie Ray, and he then goes on to tell people how great the concert was, and he doesn't remember any of it, and he's going to wait for them to come back, and they never come back.
Que ya no servía, oye tú que decías que ya no salía. Ahora mismo mi amigo yo te vengo a saludar. Escucha, escucha. Oye sonar las trompetas, oye los cueros sonar. Ricardo viene de frente con su sonido bestial.
We're just saying that it's impossible not to dance to this music, and Frank was saying some English people managed to do just that. We're going to finish, just to wrap it up completely, with the questionnaire that Ricardito el Miserable, i.e. Andrés Caicedo, completes for a psychiatric hospital in Cali. And it's just basically taking the mickey out of things, but then after that we can have a question and answer session.
Patient questionnaire number 2x26, San Isidro Psychiatric Hospital, Cali, Colombia. Questionnaire to be completed by the patient and or the accompanying person. Patient history number 1. Name, Ricardo Sevilla, a.k.a. Misery Guts. In respect of the reason for this visit to hospital, have you previously consulted a psychologist, friend, pharmacist, psychiatrist, healer, doctor, priest? No one. With an X, mark yes to those that apply to you now or have applied to you in the past 30 days. For those that do not apply, mark X, no. Have you felt happy? Yes. Participated in sporting or other recreational activities, brackets, football, cinema, swimming, walking, dancing, etc. Yes. Listen to the radio or read newspapers daily? Yes. Had problems with work or studies? Yes. Had difficulty sleeping? Yes. Had frequent headaches? Yes. Experienced loss of appetite? Yes. Suffered weight loss? Yes. Suffered fits or convulsions which made you collapse, caused jerky arm or leg movements, made you bite your tongue or lose consciousness? Yes. Suffered from a dry mouth? Yes. Had tremors or twitching in the arms, hands or mouth? Yes. Suffered from dizziness? Yes. Felt restlessness, inability to remain still? Yes. Noticed your vision became cloudy or blurred? Yes. Noticed excessive salivation? Yes. Felt wound up or stiff? Yes. Noticed feelings of sadness, weakness, or felt the urge to cry? Yes. Experienced feelings of nervousness, anxiety, fear, or dread? Yes. Used cocaine or heroin? Yes. Smoked marijuana? Yes. Taken LSD, acid, mushrooms? Yes. Seriously contemplated killing yourself? Yes. Attempted suicide? Yes. Do you hear voices other people do not hear? Yes. See things others do not see? Yes. Have you seriously thought about killing someone else? Yes. Physically hurt someone else? Yes. Experienced sexual problems or difficulties? Yes. Had difficulty concentrating or thinking clearly? Yes. Suffered from paralysis in an arm or leg, been unable to speak? Yes. Feared losing your mind, going mad? Yes. Have you felt others are criticizing or making fun of you? Yes. Felt that someone or something is magically controlling you? Yes. Felt someone is trying to kill or hurt you? Yes. Do you feel you are important or possess special powers? Yes.
That's the end of our presentation. Please ask a few questions, particularly to Frank and Gustavo, who can answer any questions regarding the novel and Cali culture.
Evening, guys. I don't really know much about this author at all, but I think I read somewhere that he failed to complete some of the works that he was writing. Is that right? The reason I ask that is if that's the case, then that sort of full loop where he actually completes that big work.
Yeah, I mean, there are some uncompleted works, but actually there are quite a number of completed plays and short stories. Whether he thought of them as completed is rather different. All of them were published after. I mean, while the plays were performed in Medellin in a theatre company that he was involved with at the time, where he started out as an actor and director, he wrote plays that were performed there, but they weren't published until after this and until after his death. And then the short stories and so forth were not published until after that again. In fact, it was Sandro Romero and Luis Ospina who organized the publication of all of his work and also organized the collection of the 1,500 film reviews that he did for Au Roi le Ciné. But he also started a lot of things that he never finished. So, yes, there was a sense of his own insecurity in what he did. And part of the reason that more of the plays were finished than anything else was that there was an urgency to actually do something that needed to be put on next month, the month after, whenever, and there were a group around him. Whereas his own writing was, he could both take more time over, but also worry more about.
One has to remember he was vastly prolific. He lived only 25 years, and he generated huge amounts of work. In Colombia, at the time when he died, he was known as a film critic. When I was growing up in Colombia, I was introduced to the films of Stanley Kubrick through Andres reviews in Colombian newspapers. I remember going to see films like 2001 Space Odyssey and A Clockwork Orange because of Andres. In fact, when he died, when he committed suicide, the headline in the newspaper was "A famous film critic commits suicide." He wasn't a novelist. But yes, he produced huge amounts of work in all genres.
And also in his life, he used to say that it wasn't worth to write what he did. So he destroyed a lot of ISIS. Luis Ospina, probably part of the family, saved a little bit, but he destroyed a lot of ISIS. He just rated extensively. But at the end, he said, it's not worth to write it whatever I did, because at the end, it's not worth. So he destroyed mostly all the things. That book, and probably was the only few ISIS he did, short stories, he survived for casualty. We never know what he did in the past, because in the six, and the Flores for him was 68, 69, 70, 71, 72. It was the brilliant for him. And there was for him was he was Sluta. He can talk because he got in front of the public and he started to Sluta and he said it's no point to talk. He just short. He went to talk but he couldn't. At the end he was and he was ashamed of this one. And he refused. He said it's no point, it's no point just to write these things here. People don't understand me. That's what he did in life. After that, luckily, we got that book and another little histories he did, and the family probably, and Luis Ospina, close friend of him. I still survived the three memos he did in Cine Club in San Fernando. Still very old. And the last letter I found from him was in 1974 when I was here, and he write it to me. Unfortunately, I lost that letter. And he said it was pity to just go to England, enjoy England, go to Liverpool, go to Newcastle, listen to the lovely music we used to hear. That was the last time I did, 1974.
How much, I mean, your letters to him may still exist because there is a small trunk that his eldest sister now owns. I mean, it went to his mother and his mother gave it to, left it to his eldest sister, which contains all of the actual manuscript and typewritten papers that he had, some of which are bits and pieces of things that have been published. A lot of them are letters, diaries, and things that have never been published.
He was a hugely contradictory character. He was a brilliant mind. He has a stutter, it's true. He was expelled from most of the good schools in Cali. He finished his secondary education in a really garage school, as we call it, or we used to call it, really bad school in Cali. He actually passed to the National University, that was La Universidad del Valle. Could have studied humanities at Universidad del Valle in Cali. And he said to his dad that he didn't want to study because it was too expensive, which was not true because that was a public university in Colombia. Basically, he wanted to be an autodidact. He didn't see the point of going to university. And perhaps that's one of the good points about him, being an autodidact. He was not polluted by academic life in any shape or form. And that's the beauty, perhaps, of Andrés Caicedo's writing.
It's strange, I mean, yes, he's absolutely an autodidact, but he was, I mean, to say that he was to the end, I mean, literally to the very, very end, the last letter that he wrote, which was, took the form of a suicide note, was to explain that he had just spent the day reading Virginia Woolf's The Waves, again, in English, again. So, I mean, his hunger for almost everything, I mean, just, it poured into him, and as you say, less of it poured out, and in a lot of ways, he absolutely felt that what he was doing wasn't good enough and no one would care. And actually, in the Colombia of the time, not many people would have cared. I mean, we are in the middle of the boom. We already have Gabo, and, you know, as long as we have Gabo, we're fine.
And they used to be the Nadaistas.
Yeah. So yeah, indeed, the Nadaistas, yes. Which is mentioned in the novel.
J. Mario Almo Valencia, the boom of the Nadaismo was in all the way. Yeah. Even Andrés was a Nadaista, but he was looking then a little bit part of the new culture in Colombia and in Cali. But he never participated with them. He dedicated his feelings, was in film, theater, and little issues, and as much as he can see, but he was myopia as well. He used the glasses.
Yeah.
So he used to be in glasses, and he spent hours going from one theater to the other just to see a film. That day used to come in a lot of film from England, from America, from France. He introduced us with the films. In that day, film was Mexicans, kind of stuff in Cali that he know with. One or two films that come from Cine Colombia. James Bond and things like that, and apart from that, nobody else knew nothing else. This guy introduced us to the Ojo al Cine. You impulsed the youth to watch the films as it is. Not any films, good films.
But
watch any films.
Not only that, something much more important than that, the critical spirit. One of the things we lack in the Spanish-speaking world, and that's something that I feel, is the lack of proper critique, the critique of literary critique, film critique, theatre critique, as part of the cultural industries. The Anglo-Saxons have it very well. You read the Spanish newspapers, and they are bad, bad in the way they criticize about novels and things. Colombian newspapers, Argentinians, there are some critics. They tend to be writers, most of them. Borges, Paz, Rulfo, people like that writing about literature. Andrés Caicedo wrote about cinema in a professional way, in a way that many Colombians and many Spanish-speaking people were not accustomed to. So that's important. He was a critic, and a very acute critic. It's criticism, which is part of the modernity, something that we don't have in the Spanish-speaking world, still developed. Still, we lack that. We are way behind the Anglo-Saxons in that sense.
The Anglo-Saxons stole it from the French, basically. I mean, the French were the first people to take cinema seriously as an art, and without Cahiers du Cinéma, the sort of reviewing of cinema that we have wouldn't exist, but also an entire generation of art. I mean, film schools wouldn't exist, Coppola wouldn't exist, people who rip off little bits of New Wave directors wouldn't exist. No, I mean, it came to us. I mean, films and filmmaking, which was the British equivalent of Cahiers du Cinéma, was much less interesting. But over time, criticism and the acknowledgement that cinema was an art rather than an entertainment took quite a long time in Britain. I mean, it's the late 60s by the time you get there. Whereas when Truffaut is reviewing Charles Laughton's Night of the Hunter in 1958, he says, "This is one of the greatest films ever made. No one will ever give this man money to make another one." And they never did.
Yes. Any more questions?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm very interested in the screenwriting, and I'd like to know whether any of his scripts were ever produced, and if they're still available, are they available as a book? Or are they still locked up in that terrible, terrible baúl?
I honestly don't know. My guess is that many of them were destroyed. Some of them will be in the trunk. Certainly the film scripts were never published. And while Luis and Sandro have published quite a lot of things, anything that they have not had access to and that they are not given access to, they can't. But there is, sadly, a film version of this book, which was at least directed by and made in Colombia, but it is set now. So any sense of time and place, and any sense of... The thing that this book most reminds me of is it is a microscopic version of what James Joyce tries to do with Dublin. It is an attempt to encapsulate a place and a time. I mean, you can, if you go to Cali, go on a tour of all of the places that are mentioned in the book. But it is a distillation of a period and a time more than it is a story about... I mean, if you take the bald story, young girl, you know, middle-class young girl goes bad, has sex, takes drugs. I'm afraid, you know, we've been doing that one for quite a long time. What is extraordinary about it is both the richness of the language and the way that it seeks to embrace the entirety of a culture as he saw it at the time.
You said that he sent them to Corman.
No, he went to see... To try and see Corman.
Did he leave the scripts there? I'm just thinking.
I don't know.
Okay.
Luis would definitely know that.
He will know about that, yes.
Yes.
No, it's quite interesting. His memory has been kept alive by his friends, and his friends were kind of reluctant to do anything with his work for a few years, actually out of a shame, or I don't know, because of the suicide, perhaps, out of guilt, I don't know. But it was lately started to become a cult book in Colombia. So by the late 70s, 1979, 1980s, this book started to become a big book to read in Colombia. And remember, it was published by the Minister of Culture. It was not published by any commercial editorial house because they didn't want to touch this material. It was somebody who has to be an intellectual, gay person, Colombian, Juan Gustavo Gorda, who said, yeah, I publish it.
It's a bit like what happened with Kafka and Max Brod.
Max Brod saved the books, basically.
Kafka actually asked Max Brod to burn everything. And Max Brod in the same way Emily Dickinson asked her sister to burn everything. And thankfully, in both cases, they didn't. In this case, it's not as though Andrés didn't want it to survive, but quite a lot he destroyed or didn't finish himself, and quite a lot. I mean, anything that existed thereafter has been the decision of his family for quite a long time. I mean, although Luis and Sandro were busy, you know, publishing the plays and the short stories and so forth, and eventually managed to publish Ojo al Cine, all of the reviews. Mm-hmm. Anything else they can only get with the family, and the three sisters do not agree about what should and shouldn't be published. Rosario thinks everything should be published. If people want to read it, that's fine. The other two sisters are a little more conservative and think that it paints him or the family in a light that they don't particularly like, so have been rather reluctant. The reason that it became a big deal outside of Colombia and outside of Latin America in the last 10 years is that they got a New York Hispanic agent to take on the rights for the book. So at the time when I was translating this, it was also being translated into French, Italian, and Dutch. And so those four translations appeared at much the same time. But I've gotten, I mean, it would be interesting to know whether any of the screenplays that he was postulating, I mean, I don't even know how finalized they were. I mean, at some level, you know, he spent 6-8 months in the States and sort of assumed that doors were going to open and everything was going to happen. He spent a lot of it in Texas, where Rosario was living with her husband at the time. And I mean, I'm sure he couldn't get to talk to Roger Corman. I mean, even if nobody else wanted to talk to Roger.
The other thing to say is that you can see this book, if you're interested in Latin American literature, as the counterpart of 100 Years of Solitude. He disliked Gabriel García Márquez. The other element is this, about novels which celebrate city cultures. You got Dickens here, you got Balzac. Madrid, for example, I don't kind of remember Madrid having the writer that celebrates Madrid. There might be novels where Madrid takes place, but it's the writer that celebrates Madrid and is well known not only in Spain but around the world. Argentina has people, obviously, Adam Buenos Aires. Even Cortázar could be argued that it's a bit between Buenos Aires and Paris. You got Mexico City with Carlos Fuentes, La Región Más Transparente. Yeah. So you got novels celebrating the city in Latin America. This is one of the very few novels in a continent which celebrates cities, and a counterpart to 100 Years of Solitude. As we said before, this novel is written and published when 100 Years of Solitude and Magic Realism is the big thing, and as Frank says, eclipses everything else, because we got Gabriel García Márquez, we don't need any other writers. This is the other writers. This is part of the other writers.
And I mean, worse still was that the boom Latinoamericano was huge not only in Latin America, it was huge in English. And so that suddenly meant that everybody in New York who wanted to publish, and everybody in Europe who wanted to publish, that's all they cared about, was magical realism. This is why it is still possible to publish a laundry list written by Isabel Allende. And then suddenly, once that was gone, they moved on to Japan or to somewhere else, but to any other form of music, any other form of novel. It was as though somehow magical realism entirely defined the Latin American experience and every writer in Latin America. I mean, so much so that there are a number of writers here who have made a career. Louis de Bernier has made a career writing magical realism. And in fact, the first Louis de Bernier novels, the first three, are all set in Latin America. I mean, it's cod magical realism set in a cod Latin America.
Indeed. We're going to wrap it up now. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much to my two guests tonight. And the only thing that I can suggest is just read the novel, either in Spanish or in English. You will not be disappointed. It's a fascinating book to read. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Give it to your children.
Setia Radio, from London, a bilingual radio, to listen and think.